Under the leadership of demagogic extremists, disorderly mobs have deliberately prevented the carrying out of proper orders from a federal court. Mob rule can not be allowed to override the decisions of our court.
The first day when I went to school, I felt, I was so excited and I was nervous. But mostly I was fascinated by how much hatred that was coming from this mob of people, women screaming obscenities, because I'd never seen anything like that.
Good morning. What you just saw was a clip from the new documentary, Journey to Little Rock, based on the story of the Little Rock Nine. I'm Raymonda Reese, a sophomore from Chicago.
And I'm Brennan Taylor, a senior from Little Rock, Arkansas. In 1957, when Minnie Jean Brown Trickey was 16, she was one of nine black students who attempted to attend Little Rock Central High School. Despite the decision of Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, many southern states had not yet integrated their schools. In 1957, when Minnie Jean and eight other black students enrolled in Little Rock Central High, Governor Faubus intervened, sending the Arkansas National Guard to block the students' entrance. In a precedent of national authority, Dwight D. Eisenhower responded by deploying army troops to usher the students past angry crowds, thereby trumping the governor's decision. Once inside the school, these nine students were faced with even more adversity. After 6 months, frustrated with daily harassment, Mrs. Brown Trickey spoke up against the harassment and was expelled from Central High School. She then finished high school at New York's Lincoln School. In 1958, Brown Trickey was awarded the Spring Arm Medal by the NAACP.
In 1967, she married Roy Trickey while attending Southern Illinois University, where she majored in journalism. They then moved to Ontario, Canada, where she got her Master's of Social Work from Carleton University. She later returned as a professor of social work at the same university. In addition to being a mother of six, she has committed her life to peacemaking, environmental issues, developing youth leadership, diversity education and training, cross-cultural communication, and gender and social justice advocacy. Under President Clinton, she served as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Workforce Diversity at the Department of the Interior. She has received numerous accolades and awards, including the Lifetime Achievement Tribute from the Canadian Race Relations Foundation, the International Wolf Project Award for contributions to racial harmony. In 1999, President Clinton presented Brown Trickey and the other eight members of Little Rock Nine with the Congressional Gold Medal. She currently facilitates the Sojourn to the Past project, annually exposing high school students to the civil rights movement through an interactive high history experience. She is currently working on her autobiography, Mixed Blessings, Living Black in North America.
2007 marks the 50th anniversary of the forced integration of Little Rock Central High School.
Her courage and commitment to education has paved the way for the integrated education we enjoy today.
Please join us in welcoming Miss Minnie Jean Brown Trickey to Carleton College.
Thank you.
That was a beautiful introduction. Thank you very much. Good morning to you. I'd like to thank the Convocation Committee and the Office of Intercultural Life for making this possible for me. I want to start by saying that these events are really special to me because it's about teaching and learning, this whole sort of thing that I like to do. I'm hoping that someone will put rhinestones on my walker or ribbons on my wheelchair so that I can have these very special opportunities in my life. James Baldwin, a writer from another era, I guess, says that history is more beautiful and more terrible than we know. And I think the Little Rock desegregation crisis fits that very well. If you happen to notice, there was a situation where Elizabeth Eckford, one of the Little Rock Nine, was mobbed. And in her honor, I'll start this off with a bang, using a poem by Cyrus Cassells. It's called Soul Make a Path Through Shouting. He wrote this for Elizabeth Eckford of Little Rock, Arkansas, 1957. Thick at the school gate are the ones rage has twisted into minotaurs, harpies, relentlessly swift. So you must walk past the pincers, the swaying horns, sister, sister, straight through the gusts of fear and fury, straight through. Where are you going? I'm just going to school. Here we go to meet the hydra-headed day. Here we go to meet the maelstrom. Can my voice be an angel on the spot? An amen corner. Can my voice take you there, gallant girl with a notebook? Up, up from the shadows of gallows trees to the other shore, a globe bathed in light, a chalkboard blooming with equations. I've never seen the likes of you, pioneer in dark glasses. You won't show the mob your eyes. But I know your gaze, steady on the North Star burning. With their jerry-rigged faith, their spear of the American flag, how could they dare to believe you're someone sacred? Burr-headed girl, where are you going? I'm just going to school. And with that, certainly for me, describes the first day at Central. And so, part of my reason for talking about this is because it's such an incredible story and it has all kinds of, I'll just do the sort of formal thing and talk about it in a very formal way. And then later we can actually have this reciprocity, this conversation that I like so much. So it's 50 years, I can't believe it. 50 years ago, that's half a century, and I'm still standing. Please. 50 years ago, 9 black teenagers arrived for their first day at Central High School. When I wrote this, I noticed that I was talking about it as if they are not me. And that's true in some way, because the images I have of that are these black and white sort of fuzzy, and I'm so pretty and young, so it's okay. I can talk about it from the point of view of them. As they approached the sidewalk in front of the school, Arkansas National Guard troops surrounding the school. They closed ranks, standing shoulder to shoulder to block the entrance to the school property. But the soldiers stepped aside to allow white students to pass through. Behind the black students was a group of adult white people screaming obscenities, death threats, hatred. A menacing group of white protesters followed, mobbing Elizabeth Eckford. But those young people, who I was one of, were surrounded by the full force of white opposition to integration in Little Rock, Arkansas. Rebuffed and chastened, the bewildered students left for home that day, and Central High, the monument to white education, remained unchanged. On that fateful day, the black students became a point on the continuum of both the struggle for social equality in education and the vicious opposition to integration. They were at the center of a clash between federal and state powers. Thurgood Marshall, who was our lawyer in the District Court of Appeals, called this situation a constitutional conflict. The other part of this is that the scenes of a first day of school at Little Rock beamed all over the world. And the reason we're called the Little Rock Nine is because the world media counted us and started calling us Little Rock Nine. We've now copyrighted that because we have a foundation which gives scholarships to people who take risks for education. But on that day, those pictures were around the world. And the students, black, me, them, were the focus of intense publicity. Graphic photographs and footage challenged the truth of equal protection under the law and liberty and justice for all, rang hollow. The opposition to desegregation was raucous and violent, supported by armed soldiers. So we did all kinds of things like go to court and Governor Faubus, negotiated with President Eisenhower. Actually, truth be told, I call, during that whole period, Governor Faubus reminded me of Dopey of the Seven Dwarfs, because he seemed to have big ears and he wore these big hats. So President Eisenhower apparently persuaded Governor Faubus to remove the National Guard's men, and they were men at that time, and the Little Rock Nine on September 23, after being out of school for almost 3 weeks, we went into school protected by the Little Rock police. Now we're in their car. We're 14, 15, and 16 years old. They've got the big guns. They're shaking. Their knuckles are white. I was starting to be scared myself. And during that entry into school, we got into the school. And while we were in school, there was a mob attack on a black reporter named Alex Wilson, which actually the segregationists accused, well, the people with the Little Rock Nine of sending these reporters out as decoys. Now, they were reporters, they were photographers, they were working, but they were black men, so they were attacked by the mob as decoys. And apparently President Eisenhower saw this, and you saw his speech, part of his speech. On the morning of September 25th, the nine black students entered Central High under the protection of the 101st Airborne Division. We were picked up, put in armored vehicle. At first, they had helicopters flying over. And in the school, the soldiers were standing along the hallway, and we were surrounded by a group of soldiers to go in. And we had an individual guard with us. They couldn't go into the classrooms, so some things happened in the classroom. So what I'd like to say is the Central High story is multi-layered and complex, and it'll be analyzed and discussed by legal and history scholars for a long time, and it requires a depth of analysis that would contradict the 25 words or less sound bites that miseducate us daily and simplify an event that is so deeply and really an example of the embedded attitudes and belief systems in our nation. One of the things I think that I learned at Central was it made no sense for me to blame my fellow white students for the terror they were demonstrating toward us, but to look deeply at the whole institution that incited that and made it possible. And if Little Rock were a movie, it would have a cast of thousands. I'm waiting for that movie. And I want somebody really pretty to be me. There was a Disney movie called The Ernest Green Story, and Monica Calhoun played me. And my mother said, "My goodness, she never met you, but she played the hell out of you. She is very short, but you could," and I was the tallest of the nine. "But she acted as if she could be a tall person." So in that cast, we would have to have a president, a governor, courts, judges, 2,000 high school students, soldiers, TV cameras, parents, photographers, lawyers, reporters, the Ku Klux Klan, lots of violent scenes, no car bombs, but other than that. And we could have the superheroes of black students with their fellow white supporters fending off violence with nonviolence. Scores of silent witnesses would watch. So Little Rock desegregation crisis was an important point in the United States history with an important difference. This history was made by 14, 15, and 16-year-olds. And that their lives were connected to countless young people forced by the circumstances of Jim Crow to object to their marginalized, perilous. You know, Jim Crow was very dangerous. It was dangerous. It wasn't just about you not being able to go into that bathroom. There was something about the way those signs were organized. There was a pretty pink door with the sign, "White Ladies." And on the bathroom for me, it was "Colored Women." So I've never been a lady, thank God. But we were just part of a vanguard of young people to object to the perilous existence in America. And it was the sort of graphic representation of what the cost was individually and to groups to dismantle segregation. So I talked to lots of young people, and they never heard, "Okay, I'll do the standardized test, see how Carleton College does." How many of you have heard of the Little Rock desegregation crisis? And I'll turn my back. Thank you. Pretty shameful for, what is it, the third best college in the universe? Why wouldn't you know about it? It's such a crucial, important part of American history that it should, and part of the struggle is to make it part of core curriculum. And I propose that the reason you don't know about it is that the powers that be don't think that you should know that teenagers can change the world. Because if you did, you'd be changing it every day. So I hope that the reason I'm sort of going around as this gray-haired elder talking about this story is that I want you to know that young people probably will have to be the ones to change the world. Because everyone else is set in their ways, they have mortgages to pay, and they don't want to get into trouble. John Lewis, who was a young person at the forefront of a lot of civil rights actions, sit-ins, freedom rides, everything, Mississippi Summer Project, said his parents said, "For God's sakes, John, don't get in trouble." And he says, "I'm sorry, Ma, I got to get in trouble. You've got to get into trouble to make changes." So here's the really interesting thing about Little Rock desegregation crisis. We had a brutal year, the Little Rock Nine. I didn't quite survive. But the governor in the next school year made a proclamation to close all the high schools. The Arkansas State Legislature seconded that proclamation by agreeing with him, and the citizens of Little Rock were asked to vote, and they voted overwhelmingly against integration. So all the high school kids, black and white, and the two Japanese kids in Little Rock suffered. So the moral of this story is that all the children were hurt. And all the children are hurt every day to this day for many of the same reason. So we have to think. Be careful what you do. It might end up in history, which nobody knows about. But anyway, when I'm dead, you'll know. And my kids and other people will be, for years, descendants of Minnie Jean Brown Tricky, and they'll have these clubs and... So when we weren't the only ones. We were the public ones. So young people faced the consequences of desegregation at all the levels, and they bore with their families the brunt of opposition and violence, the known and unknown superheroes. And a key here that we have to really say something about, in this country that so highly values violence, with the most weapons in the world and the most powerful weapon that's in the world. In that was the most amazing social change event that this country has ever known. And it was completely based on the principles of nonviolence, okay? So that too is why you don't know about it. Because nonviolence is probably the most powerful force on earth, and certainly the people, and I don't care if you're one of them, who make bombs and guns, don't want you to know that the greatest social change event, second, I guess, to the Civil War, maybe the see, we're talking wars here, Revolutionary War, Civil War. Then we had the Civil Rights Movement, which was completely based on nonviolence. So these children, I among them, were models of resistance, and by their efforts, the thing I really love is how we changed the face of American history just briefly from those old guys with the white wigs and the wooden teeth to fresh-faced black children. And the whole idea that Little Rock, if you knew about it, reconfigures history as something that's vibrant, that's exciting, that's about us, that's about you, that's about me, because it was ordinary teenagers who were able to stretch themselves and grow courage, because we weren't courageous on the first day of school. We weren't courageous. We were just going to school. But very quickly, when we saw the mob, that rod grew up in our backs that we all have when we need it. And that was for education. And it also is a whole example of how segregation in schools, then and now, points to a lack of political will, and it's based in internalized and externalized racism that is in the very fabric of America, never dismantled. Little Rock proved that young people are thoughtful and concerned about their futures. One of the other problems is that history tends to be revised and sanitized. And most often, when it involves black people, tucked away until February. So in part, we need, as thoughtful people, to engage in authentic, frank discussion about the nature of segregation, what it means, what its outcomes might be. And when we do that, we first of all have role models that look like us, young people. And we're invigorated by the relationship and connection to those young people. And the other part of having that discussion is some children in our country are going to say, am I like the black children of the Jim Crow era, throwaway? Am I the throwaway child who receives inferior education, is educated in crowded conditions? You know, one of the things about going to segregated schools in Little Rock was I longed for a book that didn't have 17 names on the first page, people who had had it before I had it. So it is all about education. One of the things that I found out just, I think, yesterday, was that the U.S. and the U.K. ranked at the bottom of a U.N. survey of child welfare in 21 wealthy countries that assessed everything from infant mortality to whether children ate dinner with their parents or were bullied at school. So I wonder if there is a correlation between expenditure on defense, indirect. Somebody with math tell me what is the opposite. Can we make some kind of, well, obviously I'm a bleeding heart liberal or something, but can we think about the expenditure we use on armaments and war and figure out that the country that spends the most on armaments and war ranks the least on child welfare in 2007. So this isn't about then, it's not about them, and it's not about those people, it's about us. So I would say, what do we do about it? What do we think about it? How do we change it? And what do thinking, creative young people have to say about the fact that we rank? And of course, UK and US were quick to say, oh, well, they didn't measure this and they didn't measure that. It's called denial. So with that, I give you a challenge. I would say that one of my principles is I don't know the answers already, but I want to be able to expand my view of the world, expand my thought processes. Another aspect of social change is being asked, who's your leader? Well, who is your leader? That's what I want to know. Don't ask me who my leader is. Everybody's in, people are always saying, well, who's the black leader? Well, who's the white leader, okay? That's a nice, good laugh. I like that. So we let's do the dialogue part. I'd like to end with something really dramatic, but most of the time I can't think of anything. So how about we relax this and you ask me questions? All right, and we have.
Hi, my name is Elijah Hall. I'm a senior. You talked a little bit about desegregation in the past and how that's still remnant or they're still prevalent in the future. Could you talk about how things are moving back towards resegregation legally and economically in school systems and what young people, young teachers need to do in order to kind of change the trends?
And now you want me to talk about world peace too, right? That's a really important question. Harvard Civil Rights Project says that we're back at segregation levels as in 1954. In part, that's one of, you know, when I say Little Rock is a cool, cool example of society, it's a little picture. One of the things that happened when the schools closed in Little Rock was the opening of a lot of private schools, private. And they were designed specifically to avoid the federal law because of desegregating. And they just continued. Now they're quite well endowed and they're huge and they take in a couple of kids of color and wow. And I worry that something that was started 50 years ago in the headspace of thinking 50 years ago, how it stayed. So there is where we have the responsibility to think deeply about this and to not be led so easily, you know, to, I call it, you know, people talk about sheep being stupid. I'm telling you, sheep are a lot smarter than people, okay? I had sheep, and I know what I'm talking about. So the whole idea is to be able to think and decide. Why are we resegregating? It's because we never well, first of all, we haven't even had the discussion about slavery, okay? We know all about what women wear in the Middle East and how compromised, quote, we think their lives are, but we haven't looked at ours at all. I think it's 1 in 4 women in America are abused. Hey, do we care? Let's look at the long, let's stop women from wearing things on their faces, okay? Because we don't look here. And part of our problem is the inability to analyze the predisposing factors that put us in this place right now. And I thought I had this great definition that comes from Dutch sociologist Philomena Essert. And one of the ways that we can find out who we are is we look at other societies who consider themselves to be non-racist and look at what a weird sort of set of circumstances that is, and we could look at ourselves. But she proposes that racism, everyday racism, as it's part of our framework, is ideology, and that's the ideology is white supremacy, black inferiority. We haven't interrogated that yet. We actually continue to build and support that in our academies and, you know, process. And that's all the laws that maintain that ideology and practice. So we're, you know, in the end, we're not surprised that the people in Little Rock felt the way they did. A woman named Betsy Jakeaway just wrote a book, and her conclusion is the reason white people opposed desegregation was they didn't want race mixing. And I'm saying, well, you're about 400 years too late on that. So how could that be a reason? So we're still, I would say, we're operating on attitudes that were part of the formation of our country. You know, that portion of persons that I am, or maybe I'm not person at all. Well, I still haven't achieved full personhood. So we have, and colleges, that's the place where that kind of discussion has to take place. This is where thought. So I challenge you to bring those issues forward and talk about them and look at the Civil Rights Project results. They're pretty scary. And then within schools that are theoretically desegregated, they're segregated inside the school, as is Central High, with AP kids up on the top floors and dumb black kids down on the lower floors. So that's an American tragedy at its worst. How's that? I don't know the answer. That's the key here. But I'm working on it. In my work as Sojourn to the Past, it's sojournproject.org. We insist on having a range of economic, cultural diversity. It just makes it so much more fun. When we have one monocultural group, we all snooze. When we've got this range of ethnicities and economic, quote, levels, it's vibrant, it's exciting, there's tension. Yes, we need that.
My name is Lovinati. I'm a senior biology major here. And my question has to do with, whenever you hear of Little Rock 9, it sounds like there's only 9 people of color in like the whole city. And my question is, what was the role of the community at that time in your life when you're going through the whole process? And how would it have been different if the community charge was opposite?
That you know, the fact that there appear to be only 9 means you need to not watch television because it's not giving the whole picture. I told you there are a million lessons in Little Rock. That's one of them. That what we focus on, how we present it to the world, you know, there were... I think historically they say 70 kids applied to go to Central, and some kind of insane elimination process. But you know what? Thinking that they needed the cream of the intellectual crop in order to come to their school, well, they didn't prove that to me. About 5 minutes in that school, I knew who was intellectually and morally superior. What, you mean the black community, right? Is this the question that's kind of framed as the best, worst thing that ever happened was integration? Is that kind of in your question a little bit?
Well, no, just wondering, like, what was the outside support for you? Like I said, in the media shots, it just seems like nine black kids are walking by themselves. You never hear what their parents thought, what the community thought, church, grocery stores, whatever you may have.
Like I said, a cast of thousands, very complex story. The NAACP, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, had to foot the bill for the court challenges because we had to go to a district court because the school board filed an injunction to delay integration. Our lawyer was Thurgood Marshall, and I don't know if you know who he is, but he's a pretty important person in terms of social justice in this country for women and all people, because that's the kind of person he was. So there was that support, which was on a national level. Basically, I think the community was, you know, Black community was in our corner. There were a few old people who said, uh-oh, all hell is going to break loose on the rest of us. And it did. But it seemed that the community was willing to sacrifice, because it was about education. It was about an expenditure of more money for Central Kids. The school cost more money. They had better equipment. Everything was in Central. The school board paid Black teachers half. They all teachers in the high school, I think, had to have master's degrees. Well, my master's degree is just as good as yours, honey. I don't think it really relates to the color of my skin. So Jim Crow laws, an inherently racist society, can do this really easily. They can determine that they'll spend less. So the community wanted fairness. Remember, integration wasn't about sitting next to colored folks and white folks. It was about equality in education. And that, I think, is where we really need to understand. And the other aspect of integration that I'd like to talk about, it was assumed by me that I had something to offer to them, and that my experience at Central would be an exchange of worldviews and ideas and cultural knowledge. And one of the problems, probably the reason I got expelled, was because I thought that. And how dare you think you have something to bring to us? Because the deal is you are to assimilate, and you're to forget your own cultural ideas and beliefs and practices. And I can't. So the community supported us because it was about equality. And if you talk to kids in the first grade, they don't have a problem with it because they see it as fair or unfair. They see it as right or wrong. And that's really how the community saw it. And school, this great social conditioning laboratory where all our values get, we all get brainwashed equally in school. And I think we thought that school is a good place because interaction, being together, would dispel all the myths that I'm stupider than you or any number of things. So I guess if I were to say, God, you were dumb then, and probably still am, thinking about this whole thing of social and cultural exchange in a modern society. So I think they supported us, and we actually participated in the same social activities they did because the law was still there that you couldn't eat at a restaurant. The law was still there that you couldn't drink out of a white water fountain. So they knew that a lot of the Jim Crow laws were still in place. So it was a perilous time for the community, and apparently lots of kids got beat up and people lost their jobs. But again, I keep saying it hurt all the kids, so.
Thank you so much. My name is Kulani. As I've worked in education, and you seem like a very powerful advocate of education, and I'm in school right now, but I've worked with kids anywhere from the age of 6 to 16, and I'm reminded of McIntyre, who does white privilege work now. The moment she realized that there was something wrong inside and it was when she was working at a daycare, and she realized that how time after time she would play with all the little white babies, and she couldn't bring herself to touch six-month-year-old black children. And the day that it struck her transformed her life. But my question is, like, although I believe the transformation of the individual is possible, our kids are dying in these schools, right? And it isn't, the teachers that they have aren't having these conversations, and the teachers that they have aren't thinking about it on this level. The teachers that they have internalized those exact same things that America had 50 years ago, and that America is regressing back into something, an abyss that it never left. So what would you say to the idea that we can't afford to wait for the transformation in these individuals to occur so that they can see the humanity in our children and approach them in the classroom in a way that believes that they can succeed? Because these children walk in at the age of 6, doomed to fail before the first day of class.
And it's equal, you're right, it's very dramatic and it's very tragic. Jonathan Kozol, who's read his work recently, about the same number as who know about the Little Rock, what ranking do you have as a school? But, I mean, what is the nature of a whole education? It's to know something about a lot of things. I'm kidding about your ranking. I read that on the internet. I just couldn't resist. But I mean, the whole idea is what Jonathan Kozol, who's a just absolutely insanely wonderful education critic, has so many case histories of walking into a school, probably a really poor school, and seeing how eager the kids are when they're first there, and going back 2 years later and saying their eyes are dead and they are lost. And I think, what is the American tragedy of an 8-year-old being lost so early in their lives? So you're right. I think this whole ESSED definition, now she's written this book called Everyday Racism, an Interdisciplinary Theory. And it's such an incredible work because it actually does the analysis about how we come to these ideas and how we act them out. And the problem, as I see it, if we still have these problems, is that we haven't talked about them, we haven't discussed them. And where is the place that this social change kinds of dialogue should take place? So that's my challenge to, you know, take it out of the realm of black studies or those bleeding heart social sciences and stuff like that. And what is the nature of a full and thorough interrogation of the social conditions of this country? So it's a challenge. And it's apparently, here I am 50 years later, saying we move really slow with basic social change, which is pretty scary to me. So that means I'm not going to even see this. And that infuriates me no end, that I'm not going to get to see it. And the part Dr. King, I have a dream. Well, guess what else he said? He said there are triple evils: racism, poverty, and war. Triple evils. I don't hear that every Black History Month. I hear that little sweetheart, I have a dream. That won't cut it, folks. Dreaming is not the way we get it. We get it by acting. So, and he didn't mean just dream and don't act. So there are 5 huge volumes of Dr. King's work at the King Center in Stanford. So we need to stop rerunning that I have a dream because it lulls us into inaction. But you got to keep doing it, and you will be doing it. Freedom is a constant struggle. I think that's a song. And I wish, well, I don't really want to rest. I think the struggle is really good for me because it helps me learn. And that's part of the struggle. And you're not going to convince everyone. But the advocacy, okay, here's what I hear people say. My kid's school is a bad school. Well, who are you telling about it? Where's that action? Where's the demand? How many people have emailed Congress people to object to one aspect of our social life? And that we're, by and large, really inactive in our own interest. So we have to be really serious about that. And you'll be in places where you can do that. That's my challenge to you.
Hi, my name is Taryn. I'm a junior philosophy major. I think that people who encounter situations like you have throughout your life and kind of stare down the worst parts of human nature, it seems like they can either accrue wisdom or they can accrue bitterness. And my question is, which one do you think you've gotten the most of? And if it's wisdom, how do you keep a kind of buoyancy? How do you let wisdom be the end point instead of the bitterness?
That's a great question, and the true answer, it depends on the day. And that I think it requires some of both. I think that the bitterness is part of the driving for a better world, and the buoyancy is part of the resistance to stop the despondency. And for me, you might think you're sitting there looking at me and going to sleep or not, or whatever you're doing, but I can feel I live off your energy. I live off thinking about answers to those questions. So I'm willing to just take it as it comes and use this energy to buoy me up and keep me going. And my bitterness, if I have it, is not about me, but it's about some of the stuff that's happened to my kids. And that I gave service. If you look at what did the Little Rock Nine do for this country, we served this country by showing what the real beliefs were and are. We gave a great service to this country. And that's all our responsibility. We serve each other. We serve the world. We serve. And it's, I think, partly through that service that my inspiration lives. And the other part is Edward Lear. I used to read to my kids. The world is so full of a number of things. I'm sure we should all be as happy as kings. Well, we got enough problems that not a single one of us shouldn't be busy all the time. So it's inspiring, it's invigorating, keeps my heart pumping. So we just do what we need to do. We serve in all these different ways.
To what extent do you believe that we can actually change the belief structures that exist, considering the most part of America believes that the civil rights movement has cured us of the race problem and that we don't need to address it any longer?
To what extent? I think I'm going to rephrase your question. To what extent can we be persuaded to believe one thing or another? I'm not going to answer that. I'm going to leave it for you. I'm just going to talk briefly about it. Let me just give you some of the language that was used to oppose integration in 1957. Has anybody heard the phrase abomination against God? Anybody heard that recently? Breakdown of social values. Anybody heard that recently? The people who are brainwashing us don't even make up new phrases. You just fill in the blanks, okay? So they persuaded us, very cheaply, I might add. And so we have to really always be resisting that persuasion and to think for ourselves. So if you know the kinds of things I'm talking about in the newspapers every time, oh, let's have an amendment to the Constitution to stop integration because it's an abomination of God, and if we have it, and in part of this movie, this guy said, both races will be ruined. There's the answer. We're persuaded to think some of that stuff. We can be persuaded to think other things. And where is the place where that needs to take place? That needs to take place in places like this. Our discussion should be on the street corners. It should be in coffee shops. It should be in the bars. It should be what's on our lips. What kind of people do we want to be? Do we want to rank 30 on the UNICEF list of children in the so-called advanced 21 wealthy countries? Do we want to rank 31st? Isn't that a bit of a disgrace? Where are we number one? What are we number one in? What? Deficit? No. That's true, too. What are we number one in? What do we have the most of? All that. And it's related to violence. Okay? We don't want to be one number one there. That's not what I want to be number one. So thank you so much. You've been wonderful. And